Well, you think it's a day that people might do too much? You think it's a day that is totally dedicated to eating instead of being thankful? You know, the attitude of gratitude is not always as present as we would like it to be when we're talking about Thanksgiving Day. And so we're not going to rehash what the pilgrims did or what the Indians ate or, you know, how the celebration was established. What we're going to do is to put our attention on the food, because that's what we do here at No Nonsense Nutrition. And if you haven't already bought your turkey, you need to buy it, because it takes days to defrost in the refrigerator, and you sure as heck don't want to have it defrosting out on the counter or sitting in a sink full of water. Not really ideal. So if you haven't gotten your turkey yet, please get it before the sun goes down today so that you've got time to get it defrosted. We know that safety is first, and I'll tell you, there hasn't been a year of all of these years that I've been in practice in Sarasota that I haven't heard of individuals ending up with, oh, drat, food poisoning as a result of somebody defrosting their turkey out on the counter or just not cooking it well. And so I hate to start out with the bad news, but you know what? 24%. Of all the turkeys that were tested had some kind of critter in them. You know, sometimes turkeys are the foulest of the foul. And so, you know, whether it's you've heard of salmonella, of course, especially the ones that are resistant to antibiotics, and listeria and campylobacter and clostridium. No, those aren't new musical groups. Unfortunately, those are the bacteria that can show up on turkey. And you know what? If you buy regular commercial turkey, it's more likely that those bacteria are there and are antibiotic resistant, because they use antibiotics to plump up the birds in commercial turkey processing. And so hunt for that organic turkey. That organic turkey makes a difference, not just because of the fact that it hasn't been fed genetically engineered corn, but it doesn't have the amount of resistant bacteria that we find in commercial processing. So, you know, when you check out, always make sure the turkey gets into its own plastic bag and then gets placed into a meat-only shopping bag. You know, that rule should apply all the time to beef and chicken, too. Otherwise, any kind of drippings can contaminate other groceries. You know, they used to think that what you did is you bring your chicken home and you rinse it off in the sink before you cook it. But they found out that if there was bacteria on the fowl, whatever kind of fowl it was, chicken or turkey or goose or duck or whatever, that rinsing it before you cooked it actually just splashed the bacteria around more of your kitchen. So we want to, you know, have good hygiene habits. You know, if you start out, and I know this isn't the most appetizing subject, start out by thinking it's contaminated so that you immediately retire everything that touched that bird to the dishwasher or to hot settings. Because the place that I see the most insult comes from ground turkey. You'd have to have a weapon to get me to buy ground turkey out in a restaurant as a burger or in a grocery store when you see a tube of pink paste. And a lot of people switched over to turkey thinking, oh, that's going to be a whole lot healthier than me having roast beef because that ground beef, because that ground beef would be fattier. But what's true is that when turkey is ground up, they grind up all the skin, all the gristle, all the bits and pieces together in with the meat. And so it ends up being a pretty high fat food. And remember, it's the skin where all the toxins are stored. So think twice before you're buying ground turkey, unless you know the grinder personally. Buy a turkey breast, have them rip it off the bone, put it through the grinder. You're a whole lot safer as a result. So please express good hygiene techniques as you prepare your bird. But we got better birds out there, and that's really the good news. That's the fact that people are not just looking to buy organic, but they're also looking to find pasture-raised turkey. And so, yeah, it's the top of the hip turkey line for you to get an organic pasture-raised turkey, because when we have a pasture-raised turkey where they spend out time outside, and they eat clover and vetch and the other things that turkeys love to eat, then it increases the level of omega-3 in the turkey meat. Remember, omega-6s are the pro-inflammatory compounds. And when we use corn oil loaded with omega-6, you know, this was our mistake regarding the whole cholesterol scam, that we should replace butter with corn oil. Well, it turned out we traded one condition for another condition. Now with, you know, closing in on 90% of all the corn grown in America being genetically engineered, we've got even more concerns about corn oil, but it's the omega-6s that are in corn oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil, and all the animals that we eat that give us an overall ratio of high in omega-6s and low in omega-3s. The human body didn't evolve on that. Our DNA evolved, for the most part, near the sea. And so we had a lot of oysters and clams and mussels and other little mollusks and critters of the sea, small fishes, crustaceans, shrimp, lobster, crab, those things that are high in omega-3 and low in omega-6. So when we have a conventionally fed turkey, we've got about 10 times more omega-6 than we have omega-3. But that ratio was lowered to 7 to 1 as a result of pasture feeding. Now, we know that nutrient balance is important. And that nutrient balance gives us a reason to want to spend the extra time and the extra money to try to find these pasture-fed birds. You know, you can actually change and improve the health of the turkeys by supplementing their diets with omega-3-containing oils. But it turns out that pasture-fed will do it all by itself. So we want to get that ratio down to somewhere like 2 to 1. We might have evolved on 1 to 1, one part of omega-6 to one part of omega-3, but with the meat eating that we do in this country, it's unlikely that we're going to get back to that. That's one of the reasons that I tell people, in order to get omega-3, you got to take fish oil on a regular basis. And those of you vegans and vegetarians out there that aren't the least interested in turkey for Thanksgiving, you still need to be taking omega-3s in the form of DHA, not flax oil. You know, there's more and more concern, for me anyway, in practice about the use of flax oil. I would much prefer that what you do is eat those fishes on a regular basis, and vegetarians and vegans take DHA supplements, which come from algae, the same place fishes get them. But, you know, turkey, well, alongside chicken, has emerged as a food that's associated with a decreased pancreatic cancer risk, provided it's consumed in a skinless form. When people eat turkey on a regular basis, and I read an awful lot of food diaries in my practice, and I was really surprised a couple of weeks ago to get a food diary from a client that ate a turkey sandwich every day. And when I scolded the person about doing the same, because you know as a regular listener of No Nonsense Nutrition that I recommend that you change it up. We try to get as big a variety as we possibly can in the diet. Well, they said, I just love turkey. And what's true is, you know, I go buy the good deli turkey meat. Well, good and deli turkey meat may not go in the same sentence unless it's organic. Deli turkey is usually filled with sugar and salt and other preservative agents. They take a turkey breast and they throw it in a big vat of brine, and that brine contains sweeteners and salt. And the turkey breast absorbs that brine. And so instead of you buying turkey for $8 a pound, you're buying water for $8 a pound, sugary, salty water. Well, I mean, it's smart from a business perspective, but did you ever notice that turkey deli meat is kind of gushy? And meat that you get off your Thanksgiving turkey is often dry. And so it's that gushy stuff that we're talking about. Of course, that's a technical scientific word. That means that it's been fluffed up, if you will, with the salty, sugary water. So I got this client to commit to one change. You know, cooking a turkey breast by itself is a no-brainer. I mean, turn the oven up to 400 degrees. Throw the turkey in a pan. Again, don't rinse it first. As soon as you put it in the oven, turn that oven down to 325 degrees. Stick a meat thermometer in it. You know, I'm a meat thermometer cook. I don't just look at the meat thermometer as a way to make sure that I've killed all the bacteria by getting the meat up above 160 degrees, but it keeps me from overcooking meat, which is a tendency that a lot of us have. And so as soon as that turkey breast is done, you get that puppy out of the oven. And so he committed to cooking a turkey breast every week so that he could have fresh turkey sandwiches all week long for work and stop buying deli turkey meat. But to think that somebody that eats 1 to 4 ounces of turkey every day is got a decreased risk of pancreatic cancer is really good news. It's not true for beef, which was associated with an increased pancreatic cancer risk. But it's worth noting that pasture-raised poultry and grass-fed beef were not used in this particular study. It was the stuff we usually eat. But when you talk about turkey, you can't talk about something that has a better nutrient density. Yeah, nutrient density. One of the things that helps us to control our insulin levels, our sugar levels, is protein richness. And you're not going to find very many things other than some grouper that's going to have the protein richness that skinned turkey breast is going to provide. We're going to be up above 30 grams of protein, about 8 grams per ounce. When you realize that an egg has 6 grams of protein, you figure out if you have 2 eggs for breakfast, that's 14 grams of protein. And even if you have super wonderful, amazing bread, you might have 2 slices of toast that each has 1 or 2 grams of protein in it. You're still going to be tough passing that 15 grams of protein for that 2 eggs and piece of toast meal. So when we're eating 4 ounces of skinned turkey breast and getting 30, 32, 34, somewhere in that neighborhood, grams of protein with less than a gram of total fat, think about white tuna would provide 26 grams of protein for the same amount, that same 4 ounces. And so when we look at turkey breast, you're going to be hard-pressed to find anything that's got that kind of protein richness and nutrition density that turkey's going to have. Well, the first thing that everybody always asks me about in clinic is, oh, I go to Thanksgiving dinner and I fall asleep in the afternoon and it's because of all the tryptophan in the turkey. Well, I'm sorry to say that is not true. Doesn't mean that turkey isn't high in tryptophan. It's got a wonderful source of tryptophan, which is, you know, one of those 22 amino acids that make up our body. You know, I always think of amino acids as an alphabet. We build paragraphs out of sentences, sentences out of words, and words out of letters. And that's exactly the same way we build a protein. Letters hook together to create something called peptides, and then a bunch of peptides hook together into something called a polypeptide. And then if we keep on going and we include all 22 amino acids, and at the same time we have literally hundreds in some instances of aminos hooked together, we create a protein, or in this case, the alphabet makes the paragraph. And so tryptophan is just one of those critical amino acids. And it's a critical amino acid because it does something really amazing. Tryptophan can turn into serotonin. And so you've heard about serotonin, one of the neurotransmitters that has to do with depression. A lot of the drugs that are on the market, the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Zoloft, etc., are drugs that try to enhance the way that the brain can use serotonin. They don't actually give you more serotonin. They just help your brain keep the serotonin you have in circulation. Well, tryptophan, the amino acid, becomes serotonin. And serotonin ultimately can become melatonin, the hormone that you know is critical, not only for sleep, but for an antioxidant for your brain. And I love the idea of having an antioxidant running around my brain at night, sweeping up free radicals. So when we look at tryptophan, tryptophan is the run of the litter. When I say the run of the litter, if you look at all these 22 amino acids, there's ones that get preferential delivery across the gut wall to get into the blood and to get past the BBB, the blood-brain barrier. Well, tryptophan has a hard time keeping up. If there's a whole bunch of other amino acids, and of course, since protein foods, all flesh foods contain all 22 amino acids, when you take a bite of that turkey, you've got all 22 of those amino acids present in that bite. Well, then if they have a race to get to the brain, tryptophan will always lose because there's other aminos that are present that are competing with tryptophan to get across the gut wall. So really, in order to absorb tryptophan, what we have to do is either take it on an empty stomach as a supplement, or we have to take it away from all other proteins. Well, that's not going to happen in flesh food, and that's mostly where tryptophan is, with the exception of isolated soy protein. And so the nature of tryptophan is tryptophan won't become serotonin in the presence of other amino acids. So what that tells you right away is if there's one sure way to absolutely positively make sure you don't get any tryptophan in your brain, it's to eat turkey. Duh. Right. The food that we claim is high in tryptophan is, in fact, a food that doesn't allow tryptophan to get to the brain. So the reason that you fell asleep on Thanksgiving afternoon didn't have one blinking thing to do with the turkey. It probably had to do with the fact that you ate too much. And it probably had to do with the fact that you needed a nap and you don't allow yourself that other times. Because if you wanted high tryptophan foods, what you'd do is you'd call all your Alaska Native friends, all the First Nation people in Alaska, and you would ask them to send you a cut of sea lion. Yes, seals, sea lions. They have more tryptophan in their tissue than anybody by double, triple, quadruple. Even game meat like elk has a huge amount more tryptophan. And so unless you're planning to have seal or elk for Thanksgiving, or soy protein isolate, or frozen spinach, well, maybe you can thaw it. You're not going to find that eating a high tryptophan meal is going to do anything to raise your serotonin level. You know, bananas contain tryptophan, and you'd be a lot more likely to absorb the tryptophan eating a banana on an empty stomach first thing in the morning than you would to absorb it by eating some sort of flesh food. Because whether it's halibut or whether it's lobster or whether it's sesame seed flour, there's lots of things that contain way more tryptophan than turkey ever dreamed about, and they don't make you sleepy either. So tryptophan's a pretty amazing amino because tryptophan can become 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan, which becomes serotonin. It's sort of an intermediate step. But if you've got all the serotonin that your body needs, then tryptophan can change into niacin, vitamin B3. So, you know, getting tryptophan in the diet is a really good idea. It's just not going to be something that's either going to eliminate your depression or make you fall asleep. Not going to happen. In fact, even melatonin taken in the day won't make you fall asleep as long as the bright lights are on. Now, turkey, you know, contains all kinds of other substances, and one of the substances that it contains is purines. And the reason that I remind people about purines is there are some individuals who are very susceptible to purine-related problems. It's called gout. Purines get broken down to form uric acid, and excess accumulation of that can create this condition that we know as gout and the formation of kidney stones from uric acid. So if we have excessive intake of purine-containing foods, you know, I think about that guy that ate a turkey sandwich 7 days a week. If somebody was having kidney problems, I wouldn't recommend that. If somebody's taking allopurinol, the drug for gout, then, you know, having turkey on Turkey Day and then having a turkey sandwich that night and having another one on Friday and another one on Saturday may just be enough that the phone rings in my clinic on Monday and you say your gout has acted up. So turkey's a great food. You know, we eat four times as much chicken as we do turkey, and I really think that the protein profile for turkey is better than it is for chicken. You know, it's not just its protein richness. It's the fact that all the B vitamins are present in turkey meat. B1, B2, B3, B5, B6, B12, folate, biotin, choline. That's a lot. And plus we get minerals. It's rich in selenium. It's a good source of phosphorus and zinc and copper and magnesium and potassium and iron. I mean, that's really a lot of good things that are coming out of that single bird. And so when we look at the rating systems of food, it's an excellent source of protein and an excellent source of tryptophan and a very good source of selenium, vitamin B3, which is niacin, vitamin B6, pyridoxine hydrochloride. But then you already knew that. I don't have to tell you that. When we look at this rich source of selenium, you know, you can't have a good thyroid without selenium. You can't offer yourself cancer protection without selenium. That's the reason that I say a Brazil nut a day keeps the skin cancer away, because get a pretty jar and fill it with Brazil nuts and put it right on the dining room table and eat one every day. Get that selenium into your body. A little bit goes a long way. You don't need extra, you know, the 200 micrograms up 400 micrograms sometimes that I give people in supplement form. That's all the selenium that you need, but you're going to get a good blast of it when you eat up all that turkey. You know, there's 2.5 million tons of turkey meat that are prepared in the U.S. every year. The U.S. is by far the world's largest producer of turkey. And I learned that when I made a trip to South Africa years and years and years ago, not the two recent trips that I made this year, delighted to go back, but I went over there and my friends wanted a traditional Thanksgiving dinner, and I was there for Thanksgiving. Well, there wasn't a grocery store you could go to and get everything. And, you know, Kenny, my ex-business partner that I went over there to visit, first thing he told me when I was packing for South Africa is bring the cranberry sauce. They don't have it here. And so I went out to buy a turkey, and we went to the butcher shop, and we did find a turkey because there are a half a dozen different species of turkeys. And the turkey that they use in Africa for the most part is not the same species that we use here in the United States that has the big breast on it. And they gave me a turkey that looked like it was from Biafra. It looked like an anorexic turkey. And their sweet potatoes and pumpkin over there in South Africa are white. And so, you know, there's something about fixing, you know, sweet potatoes with some maple syrup on it that having them white just didn't kind of fly. I remember having to use food coloring in order to make the sweet potatoes orange, and put this little anorexic bird on the table and had my canned cranberry sauce that I had brought from the U.S. And you know what? It was still a terrific Thanksgiving. So for those of you that want to know more about turkeys, well, there's plenty more to learn. What's fascinating is if you want to determine a turkey's gender, you don't just do it by the males gobbling, because the females make a different sound, but their droppings are different. And so you probably could have gone all Thanksgiving week and never learned that males produce spiral-shaped poop and females' poop is shaped like the letter J. But that information will be fascinating to some 9-year-old that you're at the Thanksgiving table with. So because the gender can be determined from the droppings, you can find yourself a wild turkey and determine if it's a boy turkey or a girl turkey and impress the heck out of that 9-year-old. But it's cranberries that we get to give the good news to. You know, we've thought for years that cranberries prevent urinary tract infections because they were really acidic. And I love it when the acid alkaline story starts to erupt and people go, oh, got to be careful of those cranberries. They're acidic. But in fact, it's the not the acidity of the cranberries that gives them the benefit, but the acids that are in the cranberries make for fabulous antioxidants. It's really the proanthocyanidins that are related to the prevention of urinary tract infections. A lot of people thought that cranberry juice was good for them. Well, if you look at most of the cranberry juices that are out on the market, they're nothing but a sugar bomb that's red. And so if you buy cranberry concentrate in a pill or you get the cranberry juice concentrate that isn't sweetened, you'll find out what acidic really means, because it is so, so incredibly tart. But these proanthocyanidins that you've heard about before, the coloring agents that show up, these miraculous, and I think miraculous is not an overplayed word, compound that's in this little teeny tiny berry that does amazing things over and above keeping bacteria from latching onto the urinary tract lining. What happened is when they finally understood that it had nothing to do with acidifying the urine, it had to do with changing the way that the bacteria adhere and therefore replicate. And now the research has gone to looking at using cranberries to keep H. pylori from replicating in the stomach lining. There is some preliminary evidence that cranberry might protect us from stomach ulcers in this way. And there is research that's being done to find out about the way that bacteria adhere to other tissue surfaces, because cranberry might just be, quite frankly, miraculous in terms of changing the way that bacteria adhere to any organ. So we might even think that if somebody got a bad wound, they fell off their motorcycle, they got a road burn, they fell off their bicycle and got a knee scrape, that there might in the future be a cranberry salve that actually will keep that bacteria from multiplying and spreading. You know, cranberries are water harvested. They grow in bogs and they float. And this has always made it really convenient. But what's really interesting to me is the fact that this anthocyanin content of the cranberries comes about as a result of their direct exposure to natural sunlight. It's their suntan lotion. When berries float on top of the water, so they get exposed to increased amounts of natural light, then they develop greater concentrations of these anthocyanins. These greater concentrations obviously provide us with even more health benefits. Water harvesting may turn out to be more than just convenient. It actually changes the antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties of the cranberry. So, what are we going to protect? Well, first off, we can protect the lining of our vascular walls. You notice I've resisted the temptations to do an expose on the cholesterol scam that's been covering the paper and the news over the last week or so, the lousy, very lousy new guidelines that were put out by the American Heart Association and the cardiovascular group. I'm doing my best to ignore that right now and stick with the Thanksgiving theme. But if you want to do something to protect yourself from plaque, well, cranberries are one of the things that you can do. Because we know it's irritation on the lining of the arteries that causes plaque to form. So we protect our cardiovascular system when we're eating things that have these anthocyanins present in them. But there's all of these other mechanisms that cranberries get involved with because they interrupt the inflammatory cycle, not only within the urinary tract by keeping bacteria from adhering, and not only within the cardiovascular vessel walls, but they also have anti-cancer properties. They inhibit various enzymes. They stimulate certain enzymes. They trigger apoptosis, the cell suicide, the programmed cell death that should happen in tumor cells that doesn't happen. You know, cancer cells are immortal. They don't know how to turn off. And so we have to reawaken the ability of the programmed cell death to take place. And cranberries have mechanisms that can affect cancers in the breast, in the colon, in the lung, in the prostate. You know, I'm always hustling the idea that you need more fruits and vegetables, but it's always the brightly colored ones. You know, this generous amounts of fruits and vegetables, you know, when the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services or the Center for Disease Control comes out and says you should eat about 5 servings a day. I don't think that's a good target. I think 10 is a good target. You know, I think that, you know, 1 to 2 cups of fruit and up to 4 and 6 cups of vegetables, the more the better. I still haven't ever met anybody who eats too many vegetables. But eating berries at least 3 to 4 times a week is a real boon. I had a little more than a half a cup of blueberries this morning with my papaya and pineapple and Greek yogurt on the top. berries are one of nature's most nearly perfect foods. And it isn't just blueberries and raspberries and strawberries and cranberries. It's all the berries. In fact, grapes are botanically a berry. So even the dark grapes, the purple grapes, the red grapes, remember, the darker the better. The more we get those proanthocyanidin compounds, the more we get of those various antioxidant families, the better off we're going to be. So, yeah, we get fiber and vitamin C and vitamin K and vitamin E and manganese and all those Bs I already talked about, but the health benefits of phytonutrients. Phyto means plant, and so all of those plant nutrients, they're all in cranberries. There's phenolic compounds in there. There's these proanthocyanidins, just like we find in green tea. There's anthocyanins. There's flavonoids like quercetin. There's triterpenoids that are present in there. Oh, I know, easy for me to say, but the point is that these phytonutrients, to have all that in that little berry, I mean, that's really quite amazing. So when cranberry juice is made, they, you know, squeeze out the cranberry to get the juice, and then they sweeten it with who knows what. But that skins and flesh that are left after the cranberry's been squeezed, that's where the bulk of the phytonutrients are. It's not in the juice. It's actually in what's called the press cake. And so, you know, that form of cranberry in the form of juice can't provide you with the full phytonutrient benefits of these proanthocyanidins, phenolic compounds, flavonoids, triterpenoids, blah, blah, blah. They can't do it because you left them behind. These proanthocyanins in the cranberry have a very special structure to them. And so it's very difficult for these unwanted bacteria like E. coli to cling to the urinary tract lining when we've got these PACs in there. So that's what they found in the research on cranberry that did so much good for the urinary tract. And this is especially true for menopausal and postmenopausal women who get repetitive urinary tract infections. We want the mouth, the gums, the stomach, and the colon to all benefit. And that's what happens. As soon as you put the cranberries in your mouth, you begin to affect the inflammation that happens in your gums and teeth. So individuals who have periodontal disease, if they take a tablespoon of those cranberry concentrates and just mix it with enough water that you can hold it in your mouth and gargle with it and swish it, you're actually going to get an anti-inflammatory property for the periodontal disease as a result of that. Cranberries affect cytokines, these messaging molecules, these pro-inflammatory cytokines that tell your body to mount an inflammatory response. Cranberries tell them to calm down. Cranberries actually will inhibit the activity of enzymes. You probably heard of COX-1 and COX-2 because you heard of Vioxx and Celebrex. And those drugs work on these COX pathways. They're key factors in the production of pro-inflammatory messaging molecules. And so cranberries lower that inflammation. So it doesn't matter whether we have inflammation in the mouth or gums, inflammation in the stomach, inflammation in the large intestine, or in the cardiovascular system. We can get an effect with cranberries. So please don't save them just for Thanksgiving and Christmas. We want to get cranberries out there often. And let's see if we can't make a relish out of it, maybe with some fresh orange, as opposed to making it into another sugar bomb. I do have to remind individuals that those of you that are kidney stone formers, you've had stones repeatedly, and a lot of people that make a kidney stone go on to make another kidney stone. There are several different mineral combinations that can make a kidney stone, but about 75% of the people in America who develop kidney stones develop what are called calcium oxalate stones. The other fourth of the individuals that get stones make other kinds of stones, urate stones, brushite stones, struvite stones. There's a whole family of other kinds of stones, but 75% of them, they're calcium oxalate. Well, cranberries do have the ability to increase the concentration of both calcium and oxalate in the urine. So susceptible individuals, keep your cranberry sauce infrequent. But otherwise, I think that it isn't problematic for most of us. And the immune support, the cardiovascular benefits, the atherosclerosis inhibition, you know, that's a lot to say about a little tiny berry. You know, everybody talks about resveratrol. Resveratrol really did, it needs special mention because a lot of individuals see resveratrol as only happening in the red wine or maybe in the red grape. Terostilbene, the better form of resveratrol because it's methylated, it's got a group on it. The molecule is altered in such a way that we get even better benefits than we get with resveratrol. These are all part of cranberry's antioxidants. It makes you want to just go out and get yourself a jar of cranberry relish and stick a spoon in it, doesn't it? Because phenolic compounds and antioxidants and anthocyanidins, and it's very cool. Manganese, vitamin C. I mean, we get huge health benefits, anti-cancer benefits, digestive tract benefits. Benefits to the gums and teeth. I mean, you know, it doesn't get much better than that in terms of all of the benefits that are going to show up. So, turkey and cranberry sauce. Great place to start, but we can't forget the sweet potatoes. And no, they're not yams. Yeah, they do have yams in the market this year. That was kind of rare because sweet potatoes and yams are completely different, and they're completely different from white potato. White potatoes are tubers, but sweet potatoes are actually roots. And so, you know, the blessing of sweet potatoes, I just had them last night for dinner. It's the beta carotene. Beta carotene, everything that we eat that's orange or dark gold or bright yellow or even the kale that I had last night, the beta carotene is under the chlorophyll, so you don't really see it. But believe me, it's there. We get a huge improvement in our protective immune cells. Immune cells continue to be stimulated by the use of beta carotene. It's one of the single best protectors against lung cancer. There's no question about that. And when we look at, you know, everything from dried apricots to dried peaches, we're, you know, it's about the only thing that we're going to find that's got higher amounts per volume than sweet potatoes do of beta carotene. You know, when I talk about 8 or 10 milligrams for a half a cup of mashed sweet potatoes, that doesn't make it sound like it's real amazing. But when I say 23,000 IUs of beta carotene, because it's a fat soluble compound like vitamin E, then it does sound pretty impressive. You know, a regular carrot's got about 13,000 IUs of beta carotene. But when we begin to talk about sweet potatoes, you're again talking about something that's packed with antioxidants. It helps to preserve your memory, control diabetes, reduce the risk of heart disease and cancer, especially of the lungs. So I remember a book I read years ago said, you know, how did Scarlett O'Hara keep her 19-inch waist? Well, if you remember, her nanny dished up sweet potatoes to keep her from filling up on the fattening party fare. You know, Scarlett could say, well, I can't eat a thing, because she pushed away temptation simply because she had sweet potatoes before she went to the party. So sweet potatoes are actually the roots of something that it's kind of a morning glory. It's the morning glory family for sure, but it's not even remotely in the same family as white potatoes are. White potatoes do have good sources of magnesium, vitamin C, and fiber, but a lot of people, they're on this no white diet, and they take all the potatoes out without realizing that sweet potatoes are very rich in complex carbohydrates. They're very low in calories, and they offer a tremendous package of protection in this beta carotene, heart smart, cancer smart foods. Those free radicals, those harmful oxygen molecules that damage tissue, are neutralized by foods that are rich in beta carotene long before they get to places like the blood vessels or certain parts of the eye. But there's not just beta-carotene. Lutein and zeaxanthin. When they found out that men who had the most carotenoids in their blood had the fewest heart attacks as compared with people that had the lowest level of beta-carotene, lutein, zeaxanthin. Even smokers who need all the protection that they can get had benefits. And so when we take in that bright orange sweet potato, not only do we help to control blood sugar. Now, if your sweet potatoes are covered with marshmallows, then we need to start a support group. Because sweet potatoes can make such an incredible difference in stabilizing blood sugar until such time as you cover them with brown sugar or cover them with, you know, marshmallows. The glycemic index of sweet potatoes is only 17. And so, you know, when you think that white sugar is measured at 100, you get it that it very, very slowly delivers its nutrients into the bloodstream. Very slowly. And as a result of that, helps to keep the blood sugar stable. But not if we turn them into a sugar bomb, which unfortunately happens all too frequently. When we begin to look at the Thanksgiving meal, no, it's not just cranberries and turkey and sweet potatoes. I'm sure that you have many other things that are going to be on that table. But, you know, here's a place where we can go back to Columbus's first trip, because they were the first ones that ever got to taste the sweet potato that came up from Peru. You know, that staple food in Central America, South America, the Caribbean. I mean, there's unbelievable recipes in Jamaica and all the Caribbean islands for the use of sweet potato. But it wasn't until the Europeans got it back and it became wildly popular. Then it shows up in Japan and China and all over Africa. It's traveled the world. So when I tried Korean sweet potato noodles for the first time, where they take sweet potato starch and they make these orange sweet potato noodles, they're very common in Korean food and somewhat in Japanese food, a fabulously delicious texture, I realized that there was a lot more that you could do than to just put pecans, marshmallows, or brown sugar on top. Because there are many, many ways that we can fix a sweet potato. And probably one of my favorites is going to be curried sweet potato soup. Saute some onion and garlic together. Puree your sweet potato in the food processor or in the blender, or just mash it up in a bowl. And after those onions and garlic are cooked through but not browned, put in a little bit of ginger. Fresh if you've got it, powdered if you don't, and some curry powder. Add in those sweet potatoes and then thin it down to the viscosity of the soup with whatever pleases you. It could be chicken broth, it could be milk, it could be almond milk, it could be soy milk, any of those things, and just make a curried sweet potato soup. Yum, yum, yum. You know, after Columbus's first voyage, Henry VIII's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, decided that she would make sweet potatoes part of her dowry. And I don't think potatoes knew that they were going to be afforded that kind of royal treatment. The king loved them, but, you know, when you look at pictures of Henry VIII, you figure he loved anything that you could eat. He offered a prize to any gardener that could grow them in England. Within the year, there were sweet potatoes blossoming all over England, but it was pretty short-lived. They can't thrive in a cold climate, and so they withered and died, just like Catherine of Aragon did. And so, yeah, it's a part of our tradition. It's a part of our culture. But let's not forget that in addition to being thankful for the meal that somebody has cooked and put on the table, we want to be thankful for everybody that worked in the fields, everybody that worked in a turkey factory. Everybody that picked those sweet potatoes. So whether it was the trucker that drove them from the farm to the distribution site, whether it was the person in the grocery store that was doing it, you have a huge string of individuals to thank for helping to bring your Thanksgiving dinner to the table. And yeah, you had to go out and earn the money to buy it, but a whole lot of people had to have their hands on your food. And those are the people that I'm especially thankful for, because they enable me to do something else with my day besides grow food. And so let's remember them when we remember Thanksgiving. Let's be thankful for our friends and for our family and for our health. And let's be thankful for the amazingly great nation that we live in.